From the studios at Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudet. This is Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We will get you updated on the news that made headlines around our region this week. And today, our panel includes Caitlin Hart with EastIdahoNews.com, Sydney Kidd with Boise Dev, and Christina Lords, the editor-in-chief of the Idaho Capital Sun. Hi, everyone.
Happy Friday.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Happy Friday to everybody. Well, Election Day is only 11 days away, if anyone's counting. So, Christina, for folks who want to vote early, can you tell us about that? Because that deadline is actually coming up fairly quickly.
Yes. So today is the very last day that you can request your absentee ballot for the 2024 general election, which is November 5th. In Idaho, voters can request an absentee ballot for any reason, although the legislature has considered bills to restrict access to absentee ballots the last few years. As of Thursday, we just got this from the Idaho Secretary of State's office, nearly 190,000 Idahoans have requested.
Wow.
An absentee ballot just blew my mind. 190,000 people have requested a ballot, with more than 106,000 returned to county elections offices. So that's a return rate of about 59%. You can request your absentee ballot at voteidaho.gov, which is a fantastic resource for Idaho voters if you're looking for nearly any and all election-related information or tools. If you've already requested your absentee ballot, you can also check the status of that ballot to make sure your elections office has received it at voteidaho.gov. And then, as you mentioned, there's also other options for early voting. Early voting is ongoing throughout Idaho right now, and it ends November 1st. Check again. I'm going to be talking about voteidaho.gov a lot, but it's just a fantastic place to go if people have questions. But check there for early voting information for your particular county, or head to your county's elections office or website for information on how, when, and where to vote early. And then, of course, Election Day is November 5th. Voters also have the ability to register at the polls on Election Day with a valid ID and proof of residency, and polls are open from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. local time on November 5th. So check that all out.
And Christina, I have to say, I mean, just the number of absentee ballots that have been requested, and I've just heard anecdotally that a lot of these early voting sites have been quite busy as well. And I know the Secretary of State says that they're expecting record turnout here in Idaho.
Yes. Yeah. Phil McGrane, our Secretary of State, has said that they're anticipating record turnout. I think the state's newsroom, which is the umbrella nonprofit that oversees the Idaho Capital Sun, reports that over 30 million people have already voted in this election nationwide. So people are very interested in this election. I think people are fired up. I hope people go out to vote. I think it's so important. I think so many people have fought for our rights to be able to do so. And it's just a shame if you don't put your voice, your opinion through the ballot box. I'm really excited to see what turnout will be. I think it'll be a very interesting election night, and we'll have results and those sort of things available at IdahoCapitalSun.com.
Okay, thanks for that. So, Sydney, a forum between two candidates for the Ada County Highway District Commissioner didn't go quite as planned the other evening. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, absolutely. So the League of Women Voters has been putting on these candidate forums to let people come out, meet the candidates, get to hear them answer some questions. And really, it's a service because I don't know about you, but I hear a lot of people during election season being like, I just don't know who to vote for. I don't know anything about the candidates. So as part of an effort to, you know, help educate, the League of Women Voters puts on these forums. And on Tuesday, there was a forum for the Ada County Highway District, District 1 race between Antonio Bomarito and Patricia Nilsson. Both candidates, they were both present at the forum at the beginning, but when it came time for them to have the sit-down Q&A session, Mr. Bomarito couldn't be found. And they kind of like looked everywhere for him. I know they were like checking the restrooms, couldn't find him. And eventually they realized that he had left. And nobody had said that they were really told that. The event coordinator said that she saw a car leaving the parking lot, but she was unclear if it was him, and she didn't know why he left. So we reached out and asked him, you know, hey, we heard that this happened. What's going on? And he said, that he had left because of an urgent family matter. Anyway, but yeah, it was just
Okay.
definitely interesting because you don't, it's not often that you have a candidate leave a forum. But that's what happened.
Okay, well, I appreciate that update. And Christina, tell us about there's a new way, right, that folks can make a complaint about voter fraud.
Correct. The U.S. Attorney's Office announced this week that there's a new program to oversee election complaints related to fraud, abuse, or interference. The program is overseen by the U.S. Attorney's Office in conjunction with the U.S. Department of Justice, and it addresses a few topics that have really been on people's minds the last few years. We know that federal law protects against election-related crimes, including violent threats against election officials, intimidating or bribing voters, buying and selling votes, impersonating voters, or altering vote tallies. So there's a phone line and email addresses from the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Civil Rights Division of the DOJ that Idahoans can use to report these types of complaints if they see them. And we have those listed in our story at IdahoCapitalSun.com.
Caitlin, let's head over to East Idaho right now. There is a really, truly disturbing video from Rigby High School. It captured an attack of a student. I saw this video, and I for folks, I mean, just know it really is quite disturbing. Can you set the scene for us as to what was captured on this cell phone video?
Right. Yeah. I mean, like you said, it is extremely it's really hard to watch. So our newsroom got sent this video quite a few times over the last week or so. And essentially it shows a group of students in a hallway at Rigby High School. A freshman sneaks up on a 10th grade girl, both of them were girls, from behind, and essentially attacks her from behind in the hallway as they were leaving the school. So she essentially gets jumped from behind. The student grabs her hair and kind of brings her down to the ground and hits her on her face a whole bunch of times. And it's a really disturbing video. She ended up not getting any severe injuries, but she did have a bloody nose. She received a lot of minor cuts and bruises, according to her parents. But the real another disturbing part of the video is there's a group of students around that doesn't help. No one intervenes. And instead, they all pull out their phones and film for about a little over, I think it's around 75 seconds until a third girl appears and kind of like gently tugs on the girl who was attacking the other girl before walking her away from the victim.
So, Caitlin, before we get more into the story, because you guys did a very in-depth story on this. East Idaho News made the decision to post the video. Why did you make that decision to do that?
Right. So my coworker David Pace worked on this story for about 4 straight days. He really did his due diligence on this one, and as we try and do with every story. But there's a couple reasons that we decided to post this. But the first thing I want to mention is, unfortunately, we've covered situations like this pretty often. 2 years ago, I covered a story of a girl at Thunder Ridge High School in Idaho Falls who was leaving the classroom when three girls attacked her, and a bunch of students filmed it and put it on their social media pages. So it's not super rare that this happens, and that's kind of a big reason why we reported it. So the big reasons are, the first one, the video had been widely circulated on social media. We were getting the video sent from concerned parents, concerned students, people who didn't even have students at the school were worried about this. The other thing is that posting the video is an easier way to describe what happened than us trying to put it into words. So you see the video, and as you know, we talked about, it's pretty disturbing, but it's something that I think really warrants you being able to watch it rather than us trying to describe it to you. The next reason is like I said, we had a lot of parents and students reaching out to us and sending us the video, telling us that their students were scared that this was going to happen to them. And the parents were worried to send their kids to school at Rigby High School because they were afraid that this was running rampant at the school. And lastly, David, my coworker, did reach out to the victim's parents, who said they were comfortable with us posting the video, and actually did an interview with him and talked about, you know, the repercussions of it and what their daughter's going through, mm-hmm. and what happens next with her.
Well, and I have to say, Caitlin, I did watch it. I watched it on your organization site, and shocking and disturbing. I don't even explain this video well, because when you said that no one intervened, I mean, no one intervened. This girl right. is being beaten up in the hallway and no one intervened. Now, you do see in the video, and I think this is fair to talk about, is you do see one student go into a classroom and then you see a teacher coming out and then going back in their classroom. Can you explain this, though, because your coworker, as you said, did talk with the victim's parents, and they really wanted to make sure that if you see that video, you understand what happened with that teacher, because it looks like the teacher didn't do anything when you see the video.
Right. So that's kind of the scary part, is for a while there were no teachers around, and it ended up just kind of being students. So there is one point in the video about halfway through where it looks like, you said, a student informs a teacher, and she steps into the hallway and kind of looks around and then runs back into her classroom. David talked to the victim's parents, who said that they were told that the teacher ran into her classroom to call for help. I guess there was a, the parents were told that officials looked at the school footage and saw that the teacher was furiously dialing multiple phone numbers, trying to get a hold of someone to help. The parents said that they don't have any issue with that. They think that she did what she could, mm-hmm. that she was trying to be supportive and helpful and try and get a hold of law enforcement as fast as she could before going out and trying to stop the situation herself, which I'm sure she didn't know how that was going to end. And so eventually school resource officers came, and an administrator came to the school, and the student was arrested.
Right. The student was arrested. But Caitlin, talk to us about where this is right now, because this is not an isolated incident. In your guys' reporting, you did uncover the fact that there are actual social media pages dedicated to these attacks, in particular at Rigby High School.
Right. Yeah. David, like I said, did his due diligence on this story and ended up finding not one, but I believe two or three social media pages where students would post videos specifically of students fighting at Rigby High School. I think the most followers one of the pages had was like 211 followers, and the page had 8 videos of Rigby High School students fighting each other. And so the Instagram page has been taken down now, but two other accounts are still active. And their videos from 2022, like their videos with mm-hmm. 700 and 800 views a piece, showing kids fighting in bathrooms outside the school and hallways. And, there's ones on TikTok and Facebook, and a lot of parents reached out to us with a lot of these accounts from videos, with videos from these accounts telling us, you know, that these exist. And it's really hard to see. It's hard to know that, you know, that there's people who are kind of instigating this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And to wrap up, I know you said that the student was arrested, but we don't know, because of privacy laws around minors, if this student has been expelled. And I'm curious to know if any administrators, I mean, what about the superintendent? I mean, has anyone said anything? Because it sounds like from the interview with the victim's parents, they're a bit, I mean, rightfully frustrated. I mean, their daughter has not gone back to school, and they don't know what's going on with her attacker.
Right. And the parents did tell us that they're not sure if she will go back to school. She is doing classes online because she obviously has, a lot of trauma related to probably going back to school. So we did reach out to district of Rigby High School administrators to see if they wanted to release a statement or an interview, and they didn't respond. But the Jefferson County School District 251 Superintendent Chad Martin did send an email to parents of of students in that district on Monday morning, basically saying that he knows that the video of the fight was circulated and that he is deeply concerned about the behavior, and says that, there's no place for it in the schools or the community, but says that they're taking the matter seriously, even though they're unable to kind of tell us the exact legal status of this the student that attacked the other student. He kind of tried to put the parents at ease a little bit, to tell them that, they are going through the court system, and that violence isn't going to be tolerated. But it is interesting because my coworker did talk to some school officials, people that are really experts on Idaho code for schools, and they said that the high school administration can only suspend a student up to 5 days, and it's up to the superintendent to extend that 10 more days. So it is possible that she could be extended for up to 15 days, but we really don't know the outcome because it's a juvenile case.
Well, I appreciate the reporting on that. So, Christina, Idaho's public defense system underwent a major shift this month. Can you quickly explain what happened as it is now a statewide system?
Yes. So for listeners unfamiliar with this issue, the state moved to this new system on October 1st, where the state oversees public defense for those who are accused of a crime who cannot afford their own attorney. In the past, Idaho counties were in charge of overseeing public defenders, but the transition has really had its challenges, including some public defenders stepping down and resigning due to pay cuts and other issues with the new system, including we've seen public defenders step down in our more populous counties like Kootenai County and Ada County. And for nearly 4 weeks between September and October, public defense attorneys in southern Idaho could not be contacted by their clients in jail after they had their phone system switch from the county-issued phones over to state-issued phones. And one public defender said the situation was just unacceptable, noting that missed deadlines could really severely impact clients' cases. So this transition has left people who are accused of crimes without access to their lawyers, which goes against their fundamental constitutional rights, right?
Okay,
So,
so
yeah, go ahead.
no, so 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 can so continue. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you,
That's all right.
because that has been some of the issues that we're all hearing about, correct? Is this inability to get public defenders where they need to be to help their clients?
Right. So we talked with one Idaho woman named Alicia Price, whose fiance ran into that exact problem in the Canyon County Jail, where he faces felony charges. She said that her fiance hasn't had access to a public defender since October 1st and is just seriously searching for answers as to why, trying to figure out how does she get her fiance connected with legal representation. She gave a pretty powerful quote here that I'm just going to read. She says, "They deserve everything that someone who can afford representation should get. Many of these men and women are sitting there in jail, their fate in somebody's hands, and they just have to sit there because the public defense system is a mess." So there are real people dealing with this transition in ways that I think is really scary to them. And obviously, people spending more time in jail than they normally would have if they had access to a public defender, it just raises a lot of red flags and, like I said, goes against their constitutional rights to representation in court.
Well, that's the whole thing. It goes against their rights for representation. And people need, I think, to really understand that we have a public defense system for a reason. But when people who are supposed to have access to this representation aren't getting it, which we are seeing with this new system, it's really becoming an issue to the point, Christina, and I have to say, your Mia Maldonado, I think, wrote a great article. If people should go read this, because there is a judge, I believe, what, in Owyhee County, who
Yes.
really took the new public def the new state public defender, the person who oversees the entire system, to task.
Right. So, Waihee County Judge Shane Darrington ordered Idaho State Public Defender Eric Fredrickson to appear in his court to respond to questions that the judge had about the state's transition to a new public defense system. So some of these people who are accused of crimes actually had to appear in court without a lawyer. And Judge Darrington took real issue with that in court this week. He said that two out of the seven hearings without a public defender present took place in Owyhee County, which led to some defendants having to wait longer in jail because they didn't have a lawyer. And he really pressed them and said, listen, I understand this transition is a big deal, but we can't have people without representation in court. Ultimately, he didn't find the state public defender Eric Fredrickson in contempt, but it was a real strong warning of whatever's happening here needs to be fixed immediately. And there's just still a lot of overhanging questions about what this means for people who are caught up in the system. Fredrickson said that the new state public defender's office is really working hard to alleviate some of these problems. He recognizes that the transition isn't without its hardships. But yeah, we'll continue to look out for stories to tell about this new system as it continues to move forward. It's really interesting because the reason we made this transition is because some of these county level public defenders were just, it just wasn't an adequate system. There's been lawsuits in Idaho that have challenged Idaho's public defense system, saying that there's not enough public defenders, that public defenders are overworked. They have to take on too many cases and can't be, adequately there for their defendants. So we've made this switch, but it feels like the transition is leading to additional problems, at least in this short term after October 1st, when this new system went into place.
Well, I look forward to more reporting on this because it is, I mean, again, there is a reason for a public defense system, and it is to give representation to those who cannot afford it. And when it is broken, like it is right now, not to say that it can't be fixed, people aren't getting the representation that they are legally and constitutionally allowed to have. So appreciate the reporting.
It's also an interesting question of will these defendants then be able to file lawsuits, claiming that they weren't adequately represented in court? Like, could that cost the state even more financially for taxpayers to fight some of these? We haven't seen that yet. I'm not aware of any of that, but it leaves the question of if people are going this long, long amounts of time without representation, like, do they have a case to make in a lawsuit setting to try to fight that? So it'll be interesting to watch.
Well, and the fact that you legally cannot hold someone in jail just because they don't have a lawyer, right? I mean, people need to understand that too, that the law doesn't work that way. So with that said, Caitlin, I'm curious about this a lawsuit against Idaho State University. Tell us about this, because a former student is claiming she was what, kicked out of her program at the school over race?
Yeah, so some of the allegations in this lawsuit are really really serious. Essentially, a former student, her name is Chinika Sintima. She was a part of the Doctor of Pharmacy program, is suing Idaho State University along with two of the faculty members, Dr. Aaron Berry and Dr. Cassidy McKay, basically alleging that they retaliated against her and because of her race, and that they negligently inflicted emotional distress on her. Satima is one of the very few Black students enrolled at ISU. The lawsuit says that only 38% of the Doctor of Pharmacy candidates at ISU are women, and only 2% of students are Black students, which is a really small amount. And so she writes in the lawsuit that she was enrolled in ISU's APPE courses, the Advanced Pharmacy Practice Experience, where she's required to basically complete these 6-week supervised clinical rotations. And during these, she had already finished the majority of them for her degree, for her doctorate. And then she was starting her very last one in September of 2023 with Dr. Berry, who's a white woman. And she says she observed disparities in Dr. Berry's treatments toward her compared to another female, white female student. One of the most concerning allegations here is each student is supposed to be provided with a midpoint performance evaluation during the third week of those 6 week rotations. And Centima never got hers, essentially. And so she asked the other students, have you gotten your evaluations? And they were like, yeah, we already got ours. So she reached out to to Dr. Berry, and there was a lot of tension there. And she ended up getting it back, the evaluation, but it was much later than the rest of the students. So she ended up reporting this to ISU's Office of Equity and Inclusion, saying that she had a discussion with her teacher about this, and that Dr. Berry threatened to report her to Dr. Cassidy McKay, who's the department chair. Part of her statement here is really interesting. She says, I'm a bit nervous for retaliation right now. As my instructor's face was pink, I am not sure what is going to happen to me. She, at the time, was doing her rotations at IRMAC in Idaho Falls with Dr. Berry. And as she became more concerned about this, she actually contacted Dr. Kenneth Monroe, who's the president of the Pocatello branch for the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And she found out that Dr. Berry knew she contacted the Office of Equity and Inclusion, and says that Dr. Berry retaliated against her, and that Dr. McKay retaliated against her and gave her lower grades because of this. At one point, she tried to meet with Dr. McKay to talk about these things, and they couldn't come up with a time to meet over the course of a couple days. And at the end of one night, the lawsuit says Centima completed a homework assignment for her supervisor, Dr. Berry. And at the end of her assignment, she attached it to an email and said, have a great weekend. See you Monday. And the lawsuit says that Dr. Berry and Dr. McKay considered this statement a threat. And the lawsuit says they actually contacted IRMAC's head of security to report her as a threat to hospital safety. So eventually, she was kicked out of her program. They put IRMAC actually placed a be on the lookout for her. She wasn't allowed on the property. And there's a lot of really concerning allegations in here about these professors who allegedly, kind of on Centima's side, destroyed her doctor pharmacy program, her ability to continue her coursework.
Mm. So at this point, Caitlin, where are they in this lawsuit? Because the lawsuit has been filed, correct?
Right. It's still pretty early. So we reached out to both sides' attorneys. Centima's attorneys said that they're unable to comment because they're waiting for ISU to hire legal counsel and appear in the lawsuit. They were only really notified about it at toward the end of October. I believe it was October 18th. Is when they were sent paperwork for it at the school. But we reached out to ISU as well, who hired a company to conduct an investigation into the racial allegations. And they told us that they're taking them very seriously, and that they immediately hired an outside law firm to conduct the investigation, but that eventually they found that the facts don't support the claims and they're going to vigorously defend themselves. So We're waiting for ISU to file a legal response right now, and we'll keep reporting on it.
Okay, thanks for the update, Sydney. Tell us where there's a affordable housing project that was stalled. Looks like it's moving forward again. Where exactly is this housing project going to be?
Yeah, so this is located in Boise's North End on 16th and State. It's the former site of a 76 gas station.
Oh, okay. I know exactly where you're talking about, because there's nothing there right now. All right. So tell us the backstory on this and why it was stalled.
Yeah. So this project was originally proposed to be a mixed-use project with an affordable housing component. So it was proposed to be a seven-story building with about 105 studio apartments, and then 21 of those were going to be at lower rents than market rate. And it stalled because it couldn't get the financing to pencil out. So, even though they had been awarded like $4 million in workforce housing funding, they got another 1.2 million in low income housing tax credit funds. And even with all of this, they said that they still couldn't make it pencil. And it was actually one of many multifamily projects to stall out in the past year or so, just because of market conditions.
So what happened?
But
What I was gonna say, so what happened then
yeah.
to be able to move it forward?
Yeah, so they've been working to find some way to move this forward. And in August, they applied for a 9% tax credit from the Idaho Housing and Finance Association, and they received it. So, because they received that tax credit, they're able to move forward. But they had to make some changes to their original plan. Instead of the 21 units at lower rates, it'll now be 38. And then 66 of the units will be at market rate. So it got a little bit more integrated as far as, market rate housing versus affordable housing. And I spoke to de the developer, and he was really excited about it. He said that it's like a true blended income project.
So they've now officially broken ground, Sydney. Do we have a time or a timeline as to when they think this will be finished?
That is a great question. When I spoke with Tyler, I did not get that answer. It is still really early, and they still actually have not closed on that 9% tax credit. They're planning to do so in the next couple weeks. But with the construction and everything like that, it's just kind of a moving target.
Yeah. Well, it's so necessary. I mean, to affordable housing. So appreciate the update on this story. So, Christina, I had no idea about this next story. I'm assuming other people did not. And that's the fact that there are 36 states plus Washington, D.C., that allow political candidates to actually use campaign finance money for childcare while they're campaigning. Can you tell us a little bit more about this?
Yeah, so there's this organization out there called the Vote Mama Foundation, which is a group that conducts research and advocates for women to have a place in politics. It's working on a nationwide effort to document this issue, to really drill down into what states allow what when it comes to using campaign funds for childcare. It worked with a candidate, her name is Trish Carter Goodhart, who's running for a district six seat in the House in North Idaho. And Carter Goodhart made a request of election officials to receive advice or opinions on this issue here in Idaho. She's a mother of two young children and says that she needed more than about 600 hours of additional childcare during her campaign. And so she wrote to the Secretary of State's office, which oversees elections in Idaho, to see if Idaho allows campaign funds to pay for childcare incurred while campaigning. I think that's the really important part. And the Secretary's office determined that that is allowable under Idaho law. Carter Goodhart said that this is really important for future candidates to know, especially candidates that are younger and wondering how to balance taking care of children while running for office, especially for women w running for office. And so she's really excited to see that Idaho allows this in its code.
I think this is fascinating, Christina, because when, knowing this, right, and that it can be used for this. I think this is why so many women historically, or one of the reasons why they don't run is because most people cannot afford an extra 600 some hours of additional childcare when you were out stumping, when you're on the trail like that.
Right, exactly. And it actually came from a woman who was running, I think, for Congress in New York, in 2018, I believe the year was. And she ran into this problem of, can I use this? What is the documentation to prove that, I'm not breaking the law by using campaign funds, for childcare? Is this acceptable? And so it kind of started this, whole project to see which states allow for this and which don't. It's really encouraging to see, you know, that Idaho is among these states and that there are many, many states in the union that do this, but the work is ongoing. The Vote Mama Foundation is encouraging candidates to reach out to their Secretary of State's office or their AG's office to try to find in code whether this is allowable or if they can get an opinion from some of these elected officials to make sure that that's allowable under these state campaign mm-hmm. finance laws.
And Christina, am I correct in saying that part of this too, this changed only a few years ago, right? I mean, being able to use these funds, I mean, it's all, there are other states that don't allow it yet, but I mean, you know, 36 states plus the District of Columbia is the majority of states.
Right. I don't know. One thing that's unclear to me is whether this was always a part of Idaho law or the interpretation mm-hmm. of Idaho law, or whether we, you know, right now the headline comes because this one particular candidate requested this information of the Secretary of State's office, and the secretary released a letter saying, yeah, that's totally allowable under Idaho law. You know, Idaho law says that candidates cannot use campaign money for personal use. So meaning like any expense that does not have to do with them directly getting elected into Idaho. So Idaho law says candidates can't use funds to pay for things like a mortgage or rent, mm-hmm. You know, those sort of things, tuition, all sorts of things. You know, Idaho law lays out some of these specific things that funds cannot be used to pay for. But childcare costs are permissible so long as they're incurred in connection with the campaign, according to the Idaho Secretary of State's office.
Caitlin, a name we haven't heard for a while is Lori Vallow-Daybell. However, she, people may not know, she's actually back in court in the state of Arizona. Give us an update, though, as to what's going on with this latest case.
Right. So she is in Arizona now after being convicted in Idaho, where she is facing two charges of conspiracy to commit murder of her fourth husband, Charles Vallow, and her former nephew-in-law, Brandon Boudreau. So essentially, we found out this week that her court proceedings in Arizona have been put on hold while officials determine whether or not she's competent to stand trial. Her new attorneys in Arizona filed a motion asking Judge Justin Bresky to order her a mental health evaluation. He granted the motion and ordered her attorneys to turn over all of her medical and criminal history to the Maricopa County Correction Health Services within 3 days. Those kinds of things include police reports, charging documents, medical and mental health evaluations, stuff like that. And he ordered two qualified mental health experts to conduct an examination for her competency. This is interesting because she was supposed to go on trial for these charges in February, and all hearings in the case, including the trial, have been canceled. This isn't the first time this has happened with her either. When she was mm-hmm. facing her charges in Idaho, she was admitted to a mental health facility here after she was found incompetent for trial in June of 2021. It took about 10 months for them to come back and deem her competent after that. But then again, they were paused for about a month in 2022. Due to more competency issues with Lori. But in Idaho, Judge Boyce ultimately deemed her fit for trial, and she was convicted for the murders of her two youngest children and her now husband, Chad Daybell's former wife, Tammy Daybell. Mm-hmm.
So Caitlin, at this point, really quickly, you said, so at this point, we don't even know if there will be a trial because they have to do this competency hearing.
Right. So it is kind of like going back in time a little bit because it's very similar to what happened in her Idaho trial where, mm-hmm. You know, some of her claims and her defense, I think, were her attorneys and her judge maybe a little bit. And so she will be evaluated for her mental health. And we're just going to have to wait and see where they what results they come up with in Arizona, because they could be different. And she could not have a trial, or they could be the same and she could be found competent and be on trial. And I guess it'll be sometime after February.
All right. Well, appreciate everyone today and all of your reporting. We've been speaking with Caitlin Hart with EastIdahoNews.com, Sydney Kidd with Boise Dev, and Christina Lords, the editor-in-chief of the Idaho Capital Sun. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.